Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. These are challenging time for Vermont's fish and wildlife community. The state's bear population and deer herd are growing, but the moose population is struggling, and officials are not sure exactly why this is happening. In addition, some species in Vermont are showing signs of being affected by climate change. How is the Fish and Wildlife Department dealing with these and many other critical issues? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today. That is Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Lewis Porter. Lewis, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
There are a lot of specific issues that I want to talk to you about. But first, give us a general sense of the state of Vermont's fish and wildlife environment. At this point, are things going pretty well, and yet are there some challenges as well?
I think that pretty exactly sums it up. I think we're in an incredibly exciting and encouraging time to be working for the Fish and Wildlife Department, to be working on these issues. And to be the trustee of wildlife in the state. We are having some tremendous successes and some incredibly encouraging signs. But as you pointed out in your intro, wildlife in Vermont are also facing some challenges, some of which are unknown yet what they will be and what those impacts will be. I would say climate change is high among them. Habitat loss of various kinds is among them as well. And those are the things that the biologists and the wardens and the other folks who work for the Fish and Wildlife Department try to think about every day and work on every day.
So when you think about the good things that are happening, what's on that list?
Well, in the long term sense, we have managed to restore nearly every species that we white humans wiped out in Vermont at one time. So we've restored the game species that are common and familiar to Vermonters now, but were at one time either eliminated or virtually eliminated in Vermont. We have great populations of bear, strong populations of deer. We have beaver that have come back in a way that I don't think even those biologists that worked on that restoration effort would have anticipated. And we're having incredible success with non-game species as well, with those species that are not hunted or trapped or fished. And so last year we saw record nesting years in Vermont in modern times for bald eagles, for osprey, for loons. And so those things are really, you know, it's incredible to see that success. And I'm not sure that many years ago those biologists would have anticipated us being able to do that.
And can you trace some of that improvement back to restoration programs?
Oh, I think you can trace all of it back to restoration programs in one form or another. Not all of those obviously are by my department or by government even. Nonprofit partners, businesses, communities, and a general interest and care in wildlife and wildlife habitat have been the source of those restorations and those successes. But, you know, for something like beaver or turkeys, which were deliberately brought back to the state, it's quite easy to trace.
Give us a sense of the importance of wildlife programs to the state economy.
Yeah, they're hugely important. Of course, any of these estimates are an estimate and our best guess. But wildlife watchers, hunters, and anglers spend close to $400 million, more than $370 million a year in Vermont. And that's a significant amount of money on a state with an economy the size of ours. We have the second highest participation in those wildlife recreational activities after Alaska by per capita. And so those are important drivers of our economy. And in a way, it's sort of a hidden part of our economy because it's at local general stores, it's at motels, it's at campgrounds. And outfitters. It's not – they aren't congregated in certain big places. So it's a little bit of a hidden economy, but it's a really important one.
So let's look at some of the challenges. Is part of the challenge that perhaps not a lot of young people are getting fishing and hunting licenses?
Yeah. And that's not just a challenge in terms of funding, although it certainly is that also. Our department philosophy, our approach, and it's shared by fish and wildlife managers across North America, our approach is that if people use something, they'll care about it. And if they care about it, they'll protect and preserve it. And I mean, when I say use, I mean that in the broadest sense. From a bird watcher to somebody who enjoys watching wildlife in their backyard, all the way through people who are avid anglers and hunters. If people care about something, they will do what they need to do to preserve it and make sure it remains on the landscape. That's our approach. And so when we see declines in the numbers of hunters, as we're seeing in Vermont and across the country, and those are driven, as you point out, primarily by demographics, our concern is partly how are we going to afford to do the work that we do. But really the bigger and more important part of that is, will people who are not engaged, will people who don't spend that time in nature and with wildlife do what they need to do, invest what they need to invest, and make the choices they need to make in order to protect wildlife and keep it out there on the landscape?
So how is the department responding to this challenge?
Well, we're responding a couple of ways. One is to try to broaden the group of people who are actively engaged with us and on their own in wildlife and wildlife issues. We're also trying to encourage people, recruit people into those activities that are directly beneficial to wildlife, such as wildlife watching, but also hunting, angling, trapping. And it can sometimes seem counterintuitive that those things that involve involve killing animals can be beneficial for wildlife, but they really are in the population level, in the grand scheme of things, both by people's engagement, but also by the money they spend, the regulations they support, all benefit those species.
And your budget, for the large part, comes from fees and licenses.
Yeah, about two-thirds of our budget comes from fees, licenses, and federal taxes that are levied on hunting and fishing and sporting equipment. Then we have a chunk that's smaller sources, and then we have about a quarter of our budget which comes from the state's general fund.
So it's really important for the programs, for you to maintain the programs that you have, to have a very strong group of people, an increasing large group of people buying licenses.
It is. It's really important both for the money that it represents and also for the fact that allows us to draw down the federal money. We have a quite an advantageous federal local match in wildlife funding, about 75-25. That helps, but we still need that 25% in order to bring those millions of federal dollars into the state.
So we got this email from Holly who wrote, "You say bear populations are growing, but how do you really know that? The real problem is that human activity is causing bears to become habituated to human food sources. What are you doing to address that problem in an effort to protect our bears?"
Sure. Great question. We know bear populations are growing because we have very solid information, very solid data on the species that are hunted in Vermont, and especially those species like bear, which have to be reported when they're taken. So we have very accurate information about when they're harvested, where they're harvested, age, sex, health. And so we can extrapolate from that. Well, I can't, but the biologists who do this can. Extrapolate from that to estimate the bear population by region of the state. So we're very confident that bear numbers are if not at a record high in modern times, are very close to that and are very healthy. We estimate about 5,400 bears or so, 5,500 bears in Vermont, give or take. And our population goal for the state is between 4,500 and 6,000. But Holly raises a great point, which is, a great risk to bears is when they become habituated to human food, when they get used to eating pet food, garbage, compost, getting into people's beehives. Because when wildlife and humans come into conflict, and those conflicts are typically caused by us, not by them, but when wildlife and humans come into conflict, it's almost inevitably the wildlife that loses. So what are we doing? We are working overtime to resolve bear issues in every corner of the state. Our bear biologists work on that. Our other staff in the biological department work on that. And also wardens do an incredible amount of work to address these bear problems, whether that means helping somebody find a supplier for an electric fence around their beehives, or whether it means working with a campground owner to get a bear-proof dumpster installed. We know that when bears become habituated to human food, not only do they pose a risk to people, but ultimately those bears are often killed because of that conflict. Interestingly, one of the best successes we have with rehabilitating those bears when they do become habituated is to get a bear houndsman, a bear hound hunter who uses dogs to come and chase the bear, scare it, or run it off. And in some cases, that can rehabilitate the bear and remind it that it should be afraid of humans and not look at them as a food source.
So with the growth of bears, are we seeing more and more bears going into residential areas?
We have had record or near record numbers of bear complaints in each of the last several summers. And we think that that is probably due to more than just the population. The population is high, which is good. We want a good, strong, healthy bear population. But we think that there are other factors that are at play there. It may be some places where humans are living, intruding into former bear habitat. It may be that the winters are not as harsh, which you would think would be helpful to the bears, but in fact, it may mean that they're coming out of their dens earlier and using up their fat reserves earlier in the year and before berries are ready or other food crops are ready. And it may be that dry conditions or other conditions may be leading to less of bears' natural food out there in the forest and driving them towards more towards people. I will just make a plea to people to call us if you're experiencing a bear problem and do what you can to mitigate and address that problem as early as you can. And we can help you with that with advice and other kinds of help. But it won't get better over time generally. I mean, that's not entirely true because sometimes bears will be a problem in a certain area and then berries or other food crops will come in later in the year and they'll stop being a problem. But deal with it early.
And bird feeders and hummingbird feeders.
Yep, all of those.
That's a magnet, isn't it?
It can be. It's one of the reasons we encourage people to take down their bird feeders in the summer when the birds really don't need it and to do their composting and other activities like that in places where bears can't get into it.
We got this email from Kelly who wrote us, "I'm wondering how closely Fish and Wildlife and the Green Mountain National Forest work together. It seems that habitat has changed significantly in my 57 years of living here. How closely are you able to work with VTrans? Do you have a relationship with them?"
We have very strong relationships both with VTrans and with the Green Mountain National Forest. And I would say better relationships with both of those organizations than we've had in the past decades. And that's really due to their folks being willing and interesting to working with us and also to the dedication of our biologists to develop those relationships and our wardens. So, yes, we work with both of those entities. But the caller makes a really good point. We are seeing habitat changes in the state, and one of those changes is we are seeing a decline in young forest. The state has a lot of middle-aged forests, but it doesn't have a lot of old forests and it doesn't have a lot of young forest. And those young forest habitats are important for some species, including some species that are you know, very, very recognized and well-known in Vermont.
I know at your website you talk about the quality of habitat really matters. What do you mean by that?
Well, the quality of habitat matters. Just having a stream doesn't mean that that's fish habitat. It has to be a stream, in the case of trout, it has to be a stream that's well oxygenated, that's cold enough in the summer, that's deep enough for them to find refuge, and also that's clean enough water for them to survive in. Just having a forest doesn't do it. You need the appropriate mix of food species, cover species, age diversification for those species to survive. So we have to go deeper, and the ecologists and biologists who work for my department do go deeper in looking at not just how many acres do we have that are covered with trees, but what is the communities, the natural communities that exist there, what's the habitat really like, and what species are benefiting or at risk from those conditions.
We just got this email from Laura who writes, "I live just over the Vermont line in Massachusetts. A few weeks ago, I had a close encounter with a Fisher cat. Can you comment on these creatures?"
Fishers are properly called Fishers and not Fisher cat, although many Vermonters know them as Fisher cat. They're a medium-sized member of the weasel family. Often blamed for missing house cats, and probably that's probably true to some extent, although probably not as true as many Vermonters believe. They're an amazing animal. I if you see them moving through the woods, I see them several times over the years, mostly deer hunting actually, because that's when you're quiet and still enough for them to be around you. They're pretty wary animals. When you see them moving through the woods, they're an amazing creature, and they were brought in, and their population was encouraged in the state in part to try to deal with porcupines and prevent porcupines from damaging valuable forest crops, stands, and they're one of the few creatures that can prey on porcupines. Interestingly enough, they also have a fairly strong predatory relationship towards animals you might not think of, such as pine martens and even lynx. There was a study in Maine of lynx that I was reading a few months ago, and of the lynx mortality that happened in Maine in this study of collared lynx, many of the mortalities, many of the deaths were caused actually by fisher cat, which is you wouldn't think an animal the size of a fisher could see. I call them fisher cats, too.
I was going to say, you fell right into that.
Well, I did grow up here. So many can prey on species that you wouldn't necessarily think an animal that size could.
Let's go to our callers and start with Dan in Burlington. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having this program. I'd just like to put a plug out there for improved signage for the fish and wildlife access areas. Both the signage at the individual sites are a little bit outdated, but mostly I think it's working with VTrans to use more of the off-premises business directional signage that you see on the road, typically black for commercial businesses, but brown for the state parks. Often have an indicator that you're coming up to the state park, and I'd like to see more use of it. The website's great and very robust, but, you know, a lot of people are just driving around and like, oh, where can I go fishing? Where can I go fishing? Well, they may not know the purpose of the fish and wildlife access areas. They may not, but you can go by them pretty quick. There's no signage that says they're coming up. So I just encourage that to help build visibility for the access areas.
Great question. Thanks for the call, Dan, and glad you're using the access areas out there and getting out on the water. Our department, something Vermonters may not know is our department has an unusually strong access area presence. We have access areas on most of the large public waters in the state, which is not true in all states. And it really was the foresight of people many years ago to buy those access areas or convince people to donate them to us. And we now have access, great access, on most of those water bodies in the state, which is just wonderful. We do our absolute best to keep the signage up to date. As you can imagine, there's a lot of work involved in keeping access areas plowed in the winter if they're open for ice fishing, keeping them graded and graveled in the summertime, putting docks in and out, keeping docks up to date, as well as keeping signs. So we have close to 100. Of them around Vermont, and we have two people who work on them, so they're hopping. But thanks for the idea, Dan. We will reach out to AOT and talk to them about that. And it's a valuable suggestion. Thanks.
Let's talk to Ross in Middlebury. Hey, Ross, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was just wondering, talking to some folks that do hunting for pheasants. They say that the population seems to have declined pretty dramatically 5, 10, 20 years ago. Supposedly, they'd go out and might flush one every hour, and now they can go out all day and only get two or three. And I'm just wondering if Fish and Wildlife has any information on the population of pheasants and what might be affecting them.
Ross, are you talking about pheasants or ruffed grouse?
Well, good question.
I'll answer both, and maybe I'll get you the correct answer there somewhere. So pheasants are not a native species to Vermont. We used to stock them in Vermont, as many states do, for hunting seasons. They typically have a pretty tough time surviving over the winter. We do still have a pheasant season because there are a couple of places that have their own pheasants that they release for hunts. And so we have a season for those pheasants that escape from there or any that might be lingering. We stopped stocking them in part because it's hugely expensive. It also can create a lot of conflicts between hunters in states that do it. And New Hampshire had a situation a couple of years ago now where a hunter actually got some shotgun pellets in his arm, I believe. It would not a serious injury, as I recall, but these conflicts can come up. So that and since they're not a native species, we no longer stock them, and so. You know, there certainly were more when we were raising them and putting them out more than 20 years ago at this point. But as for ruffed grouse, you know, ruffed grouse, we were talking earlier about that young forest numbers that decline in the percentage of young forest in Vermont. And those they're one of those species that is really, really dependent on those early young forests, small trees and shrublands. And so. There are certainly places that used to have ruffed grouse that are growing up. We do what we can to manage on our WMAs, on our wildlife management areas, for those species and for other species like that. But, you know, a bigger challenge here and a big challenge for us, frankly, is the struggles that the timber market are going through. We know that logging and timber professionals are having a difficult time in their industry in the Northeast. There's a decline in the market for low grade hardwood trees, which used to go into paper pulp primarily. And so when people can't make a living or can't make money from their timberlands, they don't tend to cut them if they're going to lose money on that. And so that decreases that early successional or young forest habitat. It poses another concern for us also, which is forest land, managed timberland that's logged well and managed well is really important habitat. And if people can't make any money from those timberlands, they may not be able to afford to own them anymore. And so that may result in those being lost as wildlife habitat.
Let's talk for just a moment about Vermont's moose population. It seemed like it was on the rise for a while and doing all right. But now what we hear is that the moose population is really struggling. What's going on?
Well, I should say right off the bat that we are engaged in a several year long study that we just began trying to get a handle on that exact question. We're joining Maine and New Hampshire, which are seeing very similar problems to what we're seeing. And they have been doing this study for a while, and we're gonna participate in it with them as well and try to get these answers. And, you know, frankly, it's a major effort and a major expense for the Fish and Wildlife Department. But it's our number one priority of our wildlife division to try to get a handle on this and figure out how or if we can address it. You're right. The moose population was significantly higher, say, in the mid to late 2000s. And we intentionally drew that population down because Vermonters were telling us that they simply didn't have the capacity, didn't have the willingness to have as many moose problems, including car accidents and other problems, as they were having. So we did that. We think that there's a possibility that decreasing the density of moose, the number of moose out there in the landscape, may have actually helped us deal with these winter ticks a little bit, because as you have any host that's in lower density, it's harder for parasites to really get as much of a foothold. But we are seeing significant problems in the moose population in many parts of the state. Some regions of the state, they're actually close to our target goals or at our target goals. But in much of the state, we're not. And I'll tell you, my personal view of it is that what we're going to discover is that climate change is at the root of it. And I think that that's probably acting in a number of different ways, the most significant of which are probably winter ticks, which is a species of tick that gets on moose and that benefits from winters which end early. We've found moose with 50, 60 or more thousand ticks on them. And it's just like having a slow bleed that doesn't recover. You just lose blood and you lose vitality, and they cannot replace that blood quickly enough to keep up with what the ticks are doing to them. In addition, they may be rubbing, moose rub their fur to try to get these ticks off, and they rub their fur loose then they're exposed to the elements in the winter. Second of all, down especially in southern Vermont, we see moose with brainworm, which is a parasite that can go into their spinal cord, into their nervous system, and kill them. That also benefits from climate change, we think, because one of the intermediate hosts for it is land snails. And land snails obviously do better when there's hot, wet summers. Third, it may just be simply heat stress. Moose are a northern animal. We're at the southern end of their range here. And some recent research out in the Midwest shows that they get stress on winter days that are over 23 degrees Fahrenheit when they can't get into the water. In the summertime, they have lighter coats and they can get into the water to cool off. The wintertime, that's obviously not available to them. So they may just be suffering from heat stress in the winter as well. But as I say, I'm getting a little bit ahead of my biologist here, which is never a good idea. We are working on this study to try to figure out exactly what's going on and what management approaches we can take.
I mean, it could be a very serious problem. I mean, could you see a situation that 5 years from now we were having this conversation and the moose population has really been decimated?
I don't know that it will be decimated. I would be surprised if it would be decimated or risk extirpation from the state. But we may be settled. We may have settled out at that point at some lower population that's below our goal population. I could see that happening. We just don't know yet. It's also possible that many species have a relationship with their with parasites where they come into balance with them, and that settles out, and the numbers of the host and the parasite come into some kind of equilibrium in a better way. So that would be the optimistic view. We're certainly concerned about what we're seeing and investing a lot in trying to figure it out.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Mercy, who is calling from Worcester. Hi, Mercy. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I wanted to thank Lewis and everything the department is doing to support women hunters in Vermont. I've been really impressed with how the department is, you know, putting women on the covers of the hunting bulletins and prioritizing welcoming everyone to the hunting community. And I teach classes where I teach new women hunters to hunt deer. They're called the Hunters Intensive. And I've gotten great support from the department. One of the things that I've noticed is one of the biggest barriers for new hunters learning as an adult versus someone who came up within a hunting family is access to quality hunting land. A lot of people think that if they have some forest in their backyard, there must be deer back there. But, of course, the deer are concentrated in certain areas. And I'm wondering if the department has any resources that they can share with the public around, like, where to find more concentrated deer areas, maybe on the wildlife management land or elsewhere, and where someone who doesn't necessarily have those, like, hunting community connections within the community can get access to that information.
Wow, what a great call. First of all, I love the Huntress Intensive. It's a great program, and I love what you guys do out there. I really think it's terrific. And thank you for acknowledging the department's work to encourage women hunters. I'll say that I think we're taking the lead here from the hunting community. The hunting community is very open, very willing and interested in encouraging people to join them. You might not think that given that you know it's a natural resource that we compete for over as hunters. But my experience is that hunters are extremely willing to encourage and help people get their feet under them. You know, you're completely right. Getting into hunting is there are big barriers there. Knowing what rifle to purchase, knowing what equipment you need, purchasing it can be expensive, learning how to do it and getting access to land, as you say, is a huge barrier, a huge hurdle. And even if you do all that, if you're successful, here you are, you have successfully harvested a fairly large animal. You're out in the woods. What do you do next? So there are a lot of barriers to new hunters, women and men. And we do what we can, including doing seminars, doing workshops, as well as our more traditional hunter ed programs to try to reach out to people about that. I would also encourage anybody who's interested in getting into this, get in touch with a local rod and gun club. The Federation of Sportsmen has a website. You can connect through that. And just go to one of these clubs and say to somebody who's there, hey, I'm interested in hunting this way, this species. And you will find people who will help you and will encourage you and will mentor you. I'm confident of that. As for what we can do to promote access to land, you know, Vermont is so special because it has this constitutional right to hunt and fish, which dates back to the earliest parts of the earliest drafts of our Constitution. A number of states have adopted similar things, but they all adopted them after we did. And the standard in Vermont is you can hunt on land unless it's posted and there's signs that say you can't, which is just a great acknowledgement that hunting is part of the working landscape and part of what we want to preserve in the working landscape. But you're right. Access to good places to hunt, to good land to hunt, can be a challenge, especially in certain parts of the state. We do manage our wildlife management areas, about 140,000 acres of them, and we manage those for game species as well as species that don't have seasons. You can find information about those on our website and where they are, what kind of species are there, and what management activities we've undertaken on them. I would also encourage people to reach out, Front Porch Forum, other ways to try to find people to mentor you and educate you about hunting. I don't at all underestimate the barrier because it can be significant. As for women hunters, we are so encouraged to see the growth in the number of women who are engaged in this activity and are involved in it, and it's just really welcome. There's a great New York Times story, which I have up on my desk, about women hunters in Norway, and they're connecting with both their cultural history, their desire to be part of bringing food to their families' tables, and their interest in getting into this. And so if you have a chance, it's a great piece to read.
We got this email from BC who wrote, if Fish and Wildlife is worried about a decline in hunting, I suggest taking measures to promote, quote, camera hunting, sponsor wildlife photography workshops, give a well-publicized annual prize for the best photographs with a show at the State House. And then BC says, maybe you're already doing some of this?
Yeah, we are. Actually, if you go to our Facebook page, it's a couple posts down now, but we have a post up there about one of our wildlife photography workshops, which one of our staff does, and he takes amazing wildlife photographs and he will encourage and help you just as we help hunters and anglers. I hadn't thought about a contest, a State House contest. I think that's a great idea. We'll look into doing that for wildlife photos, and maybe the winning entry will appear in our calendar that we publish each year also. Great idea. And we do very much encourage it and welcome it.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Brenna, who's calling from Stowe. Hi, Brenna. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon. My question has to do with reporting requirements and data collection. Each year in Vermont, wildlife, including bobcats and otters and other animals, are trapped and killed outside of their respective seasons because traps are inherently indiscriminate. I'm curious as to why doesn't the department require reporting of animals who are trapped incidentally or animals who are trapped under the nuisance wildlife statute in Vermont. It seems to me that, you know, bears and deer, there's great reporting requirements on those animals. But it seems to me that there's a lot of work to be done with the record keeping and reporting on fur bearers.
And let's expand it out a little bit, Commissioner. We have a call from Chris in Northfield who wants to know your thoughts on trapping. And Chris says Massachusetts outlawed it. Some people who are listening are wondering, why does Vermont allow trapping?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll answer both pieces of this, Bob. But let me just start with the bigger question of why we have trapping in Vermont, right? It's the 21st century. I get this question a lot, and not always from people who are hostile to trapping. Many times, those folks who are asking me about it are just curious about why we have trapping. I know Brenna's organization is dedicated to eliminating trapping. and some forms of hunting, but I often get this question from Vermonters. So there are many reasons that we have trapping in the state and why it's an incredibly important piece of our hunting culture and our hunting tradition, but it's also an important management tool for us in a number of ways. And let's just talk first of all about those species that trapping is the best way, really the only way, to manage and to manage the conflicts that they come into with people. Beaver are probably the best example. In we reintroduced beaver by live trapping them in New York and Maine and bringing them to Vermont in the 20s and 30s. And by 1941, there were around 500 beaver in the state. By 1949, there were more than 8,000 of them in the state, which just shows you how prolific and how successful they are in Vermont and how successful they can be among humans. And they are incredibly successful. They also are an incredibly important species because they provide habitat for countless other species that are really important and that we value, some of which we fish and hunt for, some of which we don't. But beavers are very industrious. Obviously, they build a lot, they flood a lot, and they come into conflict with people in the structures that we build. And so trapping is the way, the primary way that we manage the beaver species, the beaver population in Vermont. Now, there are other ways to deal with those conflicts through non-lethal approaches. Beaver baffles are one. It's basically a culvert that provides a way for water to get through or over a beaver dam, and the beavers can't figure out that they've got to plug the end of it. And so they work like crazy because they can hear the water running, but they're not able to plug that culvert. And so that's a great way to manage some of those conflicts without eliminating the beaver. But in some places, those just are not practical. They just don't work. And in those places, we trap beaver. So that's one reason. Another reason is just that trapping provides us with the ability to use a renewable natural resource and to use the fur and the meat from those animals through trapping them and ultimately killing them. And I understand very well the objection to trapping. Many people object to it on principle and I understand and I value their concern about wildlife in the state. All I'd say is that I think it's important we consider all of our impacts on wildlife. And because you wear cotton and not fur doesn't mean that you're having no impact on wildlife. When that cotton is grown, is picked, is harvested, is refined, is made into clothing and then shipped, every step of that has impacts on wildlife and it has impacts on people. So the idea that one choice has no impact and another has some impact is not right. But to move on to the other reasons that we allow trapping or have trapping, encourage trapping, it also provides us with a way to manage species that have an impact on other species. I mentioned Fisher and Martin earlier. There are other species that we trap because of their impact on other creatures and sometimes threatened and endangered species that we're trying to restore. But the most important reason is that this is an activity and an activity with tremendous history and tremendous tradition that connects people to their landscape. And as I was saying earlier, when people care about and use their landscape, they'll protect it and ensure that it's healthy and strong into the future. And that's the case with trapping as it is with hunting and with wildlife photography and other uses. Now to answer Brenna's specific question, we actually cannot require the reporting of nuisance species taken out of the season, nuisance species trapping under statute. And the Vermont legislature may choose to change that, but that's a legislative decision and a legislative change. Just a brief word on Massachusetts. Massachusetts did largely ban fur trapping of these species for fur. What they've discovered is they're now trapping more beaver than they ever have in the past. They're just doing it as nuisance trapping, in which the animal, the pelts are typically not used, and in which towns, landowners, farmers have to pay for that nuisance trapping rather than a fur trapper doing it on their own for free. So Massachusetts has banned trapping for fur, but they have not banned trapping beavers to eliminate nuisance problems, and that, in fact, has grown since the trapping ban.
Let's get a quick call in from Eric in Montgomery. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. My question goes back to the bear conversation, and why does the state allow hunters to hunt with dogs? I'm a hunter myself. I don't find hunting with dogs to be hunting. It's more of sport, in my opinion. You know, as far as, you know, they let their dogs out, they chase the bear, they tree it, and then the hunters go and eventually find their dogs via a GPS tracking collar or what have you. And they're allowing people to, or it's allowing people to, you know, chase these bears onto private property. You know, I live in the Deep Gibu, which is a very heavily bear habitated area up here in northern Vermont. And, you know, we hear dogs all night long barking and barking and barking during dog or bear season. And, you know that they have a bear treed. And I just don't find it to be an actual hunt. It's more of a sport, I guess.
Well, a couple of things about that. For one thing, I would just say hunting is partially about sport, all types of hunting. It's also about food and other and wildlife management. As far as bear hunting, it provides several advantages over other types of bear hunting. For one is you can tell which sex a bear is when it's up a tree. Therefore, male bears can preferentially be harvested. Another thing about it is it eliminates a lot of chances that a bullet is going to not kill a bear right off, as might be a risk if you're shooting a bear from a greater distance. I want fair chase in all hunting, but I want that fair chase to happen before the trigger is pulled. If I had my way, every time a trigger was pulled, it would be completely successful and kill its target, because the last thing I or any good hunter wants is for animals to be wounded out there. Lastly, I mentioned earlier the role the bear houndsmen play in rehabilitating and restoring the fear of people into a bear that's gotten habituated to people. That's very important and something that we greatly value.
Got just a minute left, but I was wondering what's happening with the state's fish hatchery in Roxbury, destroyed by Tropical Storm Irene. What's the timetable to bring it back online?
Thanks for the question, because we didn't even talk about any of the great things that are going on with fish, and there's a ton of them. So my fish guys will be calling me. The Roxbury hatchery is online to be rebuilt. We hope to complete that work by the end of next year. It has been a long, long road, battles with FEMA over how much funding we were going to get, design work, all the rest of it. But we plan on restoring that hatchery to operation by the end of next year, and we have the money and the plans in hand.
A lot of people are going to be very excited about that, for sure.
Yeah, it's a great thing in the community. You know, a tremendous number of people for a small community like Roxbury, a lot of people come visit that hatchery. It's a wonderful asset to the community as well as being a great asset for us.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion, about a lot of the issues facing Vermont's Fish and Wildlife Department. Commissioner Lewis Porter, many thanks for being on the program today.
It was great. Thanks.